Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today we're going to talk a bit about the intellectual movements in American society from 1945 to 47 that debated the future US policy that might likely be adopted regarding the Soviet Union. And we're going to look at how journalists and intellectuals shaped different approaches to the Cold War, or what was to be the Cold War. From about 1944 onwards, American public opinion begins to dramatically change. From 1942 to 44, there had been a broad acceptance of cooperation with the Soviet Union, perhaps because of the necessity of war. Perhaps because the Soviet Union had not yet cemented in American public thought as being the great threat that it later emerges as being. However, from 1944 onwards, perhaps as a result of the shifting tides of war, perhaps as a result of general war weariness in America, perhaps as a result of the creeping realization that the Soviets weren't going to be moving their armies from Eastern Europe and perhaps couldn't be trusted on the subject of espionage, the public opinion begins to dramatically change. And what generally tends to shift public opinion? Normally, the media to which the public is exposed. So, James Patterson writes, although the early months of 1946 marked a turning point in official American attitudes towards the Soviet Union, if you listen to the podcast a few weeks ago, you'll remember we were talking about how Truman's mind begins to change from indecision to confrontation by about 1946. They did not commit the United States to a completely coherent, overtly anti-Soviet policy. Truman made this privately clear, writing to his mother and sister after the Iron Curtain speech. This is Churchill's Iron Curtain speech at Dayton in 1946. I'm not yet ready to endorse Mr. Churchill's speech, he said. Until 1947, he was firmer than he had been earlier, but he remained a little tentative, in part because he was still learning on the job and he resisted making any dramatic changes in policy that would greatly increase tensions with the Soviet Union. Some of this hesitation came from considerations of public opinion at his home. This was in fact difficult to judge throughout most of 1946, but the majority of Americans were probably less concerned about Soviet behaviour at the time than the top Truman officials. Now, that is probably true, but that doesn't mean to suggest that Americans were indifferent towards the Soviet Union. They had, by and large, public opinion showed a huge groundswell of change towards attitudes towards the Soviet Union, normally negative. There were signs, to be sure, that some people yearned for a get-tough policy if that would bring order to international relations. Leading radio commentators included H.V. Kaltenborn and Edward Murrow, of who had reported from London during the Blitz and was a famous wartime correspondent. seems sympathetic to such an approach, especially with regards to Western Europe, which virtually all shades of American opinion considered the most strategically vital area of the world. So there were other publications, particularly Life and Time, the two periodicals of generally kind of centre-ground educated American thought, which reported from China, reported on the activities of Mao's Communist Party as it gained ground against Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists. And the both publications, for example, gave a kind of very selective view of what was happening, presenting the communists as all bad and the nationalists as entirely virtuous, which is not the case whatsoever. You only need to read about what happened when Chiang Kai-shek got to Taiwan to get a flavour of the man in the terror that followed, to which allowed China, the Kuomintang, to establish its rule on the island. 30,000 dissidents and members of civil society were murdered. There were some writers who helped to harden attitudes amongst Americans, often less kind of ideologically renowned or less partisan figures, particularly, for example, the cultural critic Brooks Atkinson and the editor John Fisher. Both went to the Soviet Union in 1946 and wrote articles describing what they saw. Neither had been particularly anti-Soviet, but both found the Soviet Union at the end of World War II a totalitarian society. And this is hardly surprising. Not only did one have to contend with the culture and the policies of Stalinism, but also the effect of a war in which 27 million Soviet citizens had been killed, and that the entire state had had to be mobilised in order to win that war. The Book of the Month club selection for, I think it was July 1946, was Fisher's book, Why They Behave Like Russians, which sold hundreds of thousands of copies. And sometimes books like that are a kind of a weather vane. They sort of show you which way the wind is blowing. They're an interesting kind of snapshot as to public attitudes. There were liberals in America who wanted to avoid confrontation, who wanted to resist having a harder policies. For example, Claude Pepper of Florida, Glenn Taylor of Idaho, and Harley Kilgore of West Virginia all issue a joint statement following the Iron Curtain speech, and it read, "Mr. Churchill's proposal would cut the throat of the Big Three, without which the war could not have been won, and without which the peace cannot be saved." So there's an interesting continuity, and it's possible that this was a widespread view, that the Big Three not only were a kind of a war-winning team, but this was the organisation that would, the alliance that would build a lasting peace. There was the fear, of course, that an anti-Soviet policy would bring about war. You see, unfortunately, appeasement had left policymakers with an appalling dilemma. The legacy of appeasement was that if one did not instantly stand up to an expansionist, undemocratic power, then the result would be expansion by that power, and eventually war on the expansionist and democratic powers' terms. However, the belief was that perhaps there was a way of avoiding war still in the other camp, that by standing up to expansionist, aggressive, warlike and democratic power, one actually precipitates the war one is trying to avoid. And this was something that would divide America, indeed divide the West, into kind of hawkish and dovish camps, liberal and conservative camps. And the idea that the lessons of appeasement in Hitler needed to be learned, or had not indeed been yet learned, was a kind of a ghost that would haunt Cold War politics. The reporter Thomas Stokes noted, "If someone doesn't call a halt, the interests in this country, who seem hell-bent on war with Russia and soon, will get their way. Lots of people seem to have gone completely mad." But this is to slightly misunderstand, in a way, liberal politics in America. Liberal politics, if you exclude the sort of the tiny strand of the kind of the fellow traveller movement, who went to the Soviet Union and thought it was just fine and dandy under Stalin, there was a broad body of liberal thought in America that was anti-communist, anti-Soviet, opposed Soviet expansion in Europe, did not trust Stalin, and simply because they wanted to avoid an all-out war with the Soviet Union didn't mean they had any love for it as an entity. They thought it was unwise to pour money into the Chinese nationalists because it was entirely suspected that they would turn out to be just as undemocratic and violent and repressive as the communists might be. And they recognised that Eastern Europe would be a Soviet sphere of influence. And perhaps this was the essence of liberal thinking when it came to foreign policy, was to establish settled relations as being the best of a bad set of circumstances, whereas more hawkish, more conservative, more radical anti-communist thought was based in the idea that communism needed to be confronted, that the established order must be of the Western world must be strongly protected. So, James Patterson writes, one such writer, and he's referring to the liberal perspective, was Reinhold Niebuhr, who was by far the most highly regarded of anti-communist liberals during the late 1940s. In his many writings at the time, Niebuhr aroused a generation of younger liberals. The historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Was the best known of these, to greater awareness of the Soviet threat. But Niebuhr was uncomfortable with what he considered to be excessively moralistic responses from Washington. In September 1946, he wrote in The Nation that the United States should end its futile efforts to change what cannot be changed in Eastern Europe, regarded by Russia as its strategic security belt. He wrote, Western efforts to change conditions in Poland or in Bulgaria, for instance, will prove futile in any event, partly because Russians are there and we aren't, partly because such slogans as free elections and free enterprise are irrelevant in that part of the world. Our copybook versions of democracy are frequently as obtuse as Russian dogmatism. If we left Russia alone in that part of the world, in the part of the world it has staked out, we might actually help rather than hinder the indigenous forces which resist its heavy hand. So, to some extent, you could argue that the commentariat of the mid 1940s, the likes of Niebuhr, the likes of Fischer, set the mood for the kind of the tone of debate. But it's always Congress that decides, particularly when it comes to a cautious president like Truman, or a president like Truman who was still undecided about policy direction.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Congress itself, up until 1946, is relatively risk-averse and can't be ignored. So Truman was always more likely to come down on the side of Congress rather than risk a fight with the houses that he was unlikely to win, particularly as he didn't necessarily have the concrete public support for the Cold War. So you have, from as almost every tier in American society up to 1946, this degree of indecision. It would be in 1947 Truman's hand would be forced, but we'll come to that in due course. This caution kind of reflects the weariness that America had from the Second World War, and still there's still that sense that, whilst the Second World War had been the good war, that it had been America's intervention had been the kind of America's gift to the world, and the world really had been a kind of a huge encumbrance on America's energies and blood and treasure. The decline in military spending is another determinant. There were huge cuts to military expenditure in 1945 and 46. There's a brilliant book, and you should read it before it goes out of print, called The Arms Bazaar by Anthony Sampson. And he basically makes the point that the entire economy of California virtually collapses at the end of the Second World War because of the end of the of massive contracts from the aviation to the aviation industry from the government. And the government have to find all sorts of ways of subsidising and giving bungs to civilian military and then ramping up aircraft production as a result of the growing Cold War. The Navy had to sell 4,000 ships and scrap 2,000 more and shut down 84 shipyards. There were close to mutinous conditions in the army in 1946, as there were veterans who had been kept behind in Europe month after month and demanded release and demanded demobilisation. The Americans knew, as did the Soviets, that their fighting power in Europe was draining away at the end of the Second World War, in the months after the Second World War, and that had if the Soviets were minded to do so, perhaps even risking the possibility of a nuclear strike on the Soviet Union, they could have marched to the English Channel without much trouble. The policy that the British and the Americans had was to leave Europe as soon as possible, and if there had been a Soviet attack, to evacuate immediately. American forces probably evacuating to Great Britain and then back to the USA, because there's simply no way that the Allied armies could contend with the size of the Red Army. In April 1946, the Congress extended the draft all the way through to March 1947, and then called for voluntary recruitment from April 1947 to August 1948. the Congress rejected efforts by Truman to introduce universal military training. This was seen as being a gross intrusion into the civil liberties of individuals and the state dictating what individuals did and how they acted. This is considered to be wildly unconstitutional and un-American. So, defense spending fell from $81.6 billion in 1945 to $44.7 billion in 1946 and to $13 billion in 1947. So there's a dramatic decline in defense spending. And this was another reason why throughout 1946, Congress and Truman are ill-inclined to confront the Soviet Union, perhaps having to use the threat of military manpower or firepower when the Soviet Union would know full well that military power in the USA was in retreat. So up until 1950, the $13.1 billion level of spending is basically kept. And it's only the Korean War that sends arms spending back through the roof. The federal government actually, in 1947 and 49, and this tells you a lot about Americans' arms spending, began to run a surplus. So there is a very interesting story, not a story for this episode, yeah, but perhaps in the future, about American arms spending and deficits. The US Army was 1.5 million strong by mid-1945, mainly at home in the US or on occupation duty in Europe and in Japan. Though America actually did still have the largest Navy and Air Force in the world, it was ground troops that America, in comparative terms, compared to the Soviet Union, was short on. It was observed at the time that to intervene in anything greater than a minor conflict, such as a territorial dispute between Italy and Yugoslavia, would have been impossible. It's possible that Stalin also knew that the atomic bomb was something of a paper tiger. The reason for that isn't the bomb itself, but it's the means of delivery. Until 1950... the US Air Force was relying on the B-29 bomber. The B-29 bomber did not have the range from the US to the USSR. Perhaps it could have been flown from somewhere in Europe, but the B-29s weren't stationed there. They were stationed in Texas, Louisiana, and California. So it was only when a new generation of long-range B-36 bombers were ready in 1950, that there was the possibility of a strike over the USSR. And so the atomic shield of the USSR, of the USA, is patchy during the last half of the 1940s. The Americans have seven atomic bombs by mid-1946, and by 1947, they had 13. They are not easy to use. The reason why it was possible to use an atomic bomb over Nagasaki and Hiroshima was that by 1945, the Americans had already won an air war over Japan and had comprehensively destroyed Japanese air defences anyway. It would be a very different prospect over the Soviet Union. Only specially designed B-29s were able to carry the bombs, and the bombs themselves, this type of bombing was not necessarily particularly precise. A bomb test at Bikini in the Pacific in 1946 missed the target by 2 miles. Also, uranium at that point was scarce, perhaps they were unaware you could refine it from seawater, and advocates of strategic bombing thought that the weapons of the Second World War, mainly high explosives and firebombs would still be the means by which Soviet cities would be razed to the ground in a future war. So the Soviets would have been as circumspect as the Americans were, because the Soviets were successfully spying on the Americans and were still willing to take gambles when it came to war. So those supporters of a get tough policy on the USSR also found that there was mixed feelings about this from major groups that you would normally look to. The army, of course, were looking for higher allocations of men and money and resources. This is what armed services do. And the State Department generally looked its role as making sure that American interests were protected, but that didn't always mean confronting the USSR. The military-industrial complex, which was a term that was coined by Eisenhower at the end of his second term, was less of a kind of a combined entity in 1945-46 than it was later on. And most American industrialists saw returns coming from consumer market. They thought repurposing American industry to provide for the needs of a new generation of American homeowners and consumers was going to be the way in which returns on investment would really, really happen. So they themselves were not necessarily clamouring for big defence contracts, but obviously that changes later on. Now, in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to do a couple of podcasts on the Truman Doctrine. And it is the Truman Doctrine that suddenly changes all this kind of indecision and doubt, partly because the circumstances internationally change. And then when that occurs, Truman has to amend how he approaches the question of the Soviet Union. But until then, have a great week or two, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.